It's Lars. Thank you for checking out my podcast, and have a great day.
Lars. Together, we can forge a new beginning for America.
The 45th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And yes, together, we will make America great again. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless America.
Now, honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you on this Tuesday evening, and I'm always glad to get your phone calls and emails. And on this program, naysayers always go to the head of the line. Well, the Lone Star State has sent the first-of-its-kind waiver to exclude funding for abortion providers. If approved by the president, it could set off a chain reaction for other states to start similar programs. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell pushed back the August recess to give more time to complete action on important legislative items and process nominees stalled from across the aisle. That's some great news. The Senate deciding that they don't need to take the entire month of August off, that they actually have work to do in Washington, D.C. Internet hacking and stealing of sensitive info can happen to even the safest online user. I'll talk with an internet security expert who will tell us how to keep our information safe, or if not safe, at least safer than it would have been. And healthcare reform will never be perfect from either side of the aisle, but there is one key aspect that both sides seem to miss. We'll talk about that tonight as well. Plus, if you saw people being swept away in the ocean, would you react right away and form a human chain or wait for a rescue? There's an amazing story out of Florida. I'll tell you about a courageous group of people who took that action and acted within minutes and saved lives, even when the official lifeguards were unwilling to go out in the water and rescue those people who were being swept away by a riptide. And please cast your vote in my quick poll. You'll find it online at LarsLarson.com. Should the role of a blind man in a new movie be played by a non-blind actor? And should we apply the same kind of rules for other characters, fictional characters with disabilities? Should they only be played by people who have that same kind of disability? You'll find the quick poll at LarsLarson.com, brought to you by AMAC. AMAC's better. Better for you and better for America. Join the group that I've been a member of for years by going to amac.us, not .com. You can also call and join 888-262-2006. In yesterday's quick poll, we asked you, should the British government be able to block a terminally ill child from coming to America for treatment? Only 12% of you agreed the British government should be able to shut down that trip and keep the child from coming to America. 88% of you said, no way. Charlie Gard should be able to come to the United States. His parents have raised the money for his treatment, and he should be able to get it even if he has to leave England and come to the United States. And while you're on the website, visit my trophy room at LarsLarson.com. Post a picture and a paragraph about your latest hunting or fishing adventures, and you've got the chance to win some great prizes, and everybody else gets a chance to enjoy the pictures. And I flip through that about once a week and take a look at those pictures. There are some fantastic family hunting trips that are pictured there, and there's room enough for all of you. You find it at LarsLarson.com. You want to join the best conversation in talk journalism? It's at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. I have to applaud the state of Texas and Governor Greg Abbott for sending the first-of-its-kind waiver to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, asking the agency to approve federal funding for a state-administered family planning program that does not include abortion providers or their affiliates. And if the Trump administration approves that request, Texas Right to Life Legislative Director John Ciego says it could set off a chain reaction, he says, for the majority of states that want to provide family planning without sending taxpayer dollars to the abortion industry. That is a win-win solution. I think it's also a win-win to hold the members of the U.S. Senate in Washington, D.C., and that's exactly what Mitch McConnell decided today he would do, pushing off the start of the August recess for at least 2 weeks to make sure that the Senate can actually finish its work before it goes home for a short break. And I think that makes sense as well. Oh, and about that human chain, the story is amazing. It's about a group of people, a family, four children and two adults who were swept out to sea by a riptide. Now, if you've ever been, I've been on the Florida coast a couple of times on vacation and a couple of times for work. Those riptides can be awfully dangerous. And it didn't matter. These folks tried to save themselves. It didn't matter if they swam in a straight line or swam along the shore. They were not going to be able to get back in. They were 100 yards out in the ocean. And the official lifeguards on the beach who had responded to the emergency said, we're going to wait until we get a rescue boat to be able to go and reach these people. So a group of enterprising Americans standing on that beach said, let's form a human chain. Now, there are risks to that because you could get caught up in the same riptide that those folks who were out to sea were caught up in. Almost 100 people formed a human chain. Some of them had boogie boards. Some of them had surfboards, other floatable devices. They formed a human chain all the way out to where these people were stuck, and then they rescued them. The pictures are absolutely amazing. 8 people, actually a total of 9 people, had their lives saved by this action, including one woman who suffered a heart attack while she was in the water. They managed to pass them hand over hand along that human chain all the way back to the beach. They took action because they understood that when seconds count, you've got to act. You can't wait to get that rescue boat. Now, to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. I want to go back to Jackie in Virginia, who had called me earlier, and we ran out of time at the top of the hour. Jackie, you were talking about the young girl who was walking past a statue of General Lee in a park there in your hometown of Charlottesville, Virginia. What happened?
Well, she told officials that, or a policeman or someone, that she was intimidated by the mounted, Robert E. Lee on his horse Traveler. Statue of this beautiful statue in a nice little park called Lee Park, and the city people in this area they bought this, they believed it, this forwards their agenda, I guess. It's very liberal in this area. It used to be very conservative, but then we have all these people moving down here from the north, and they brought their liberal ideas with them. But anyway, besides that, there are some, I just don't understand how they can actually tell people anywhere that a kid or anybody can be intimidated by a statue.
That doesn't make sense, does it?
No, it doesn't. And they would be removing that statue if it were a state law that you cannot remove a war memorial.
What do you think the parents of that child taught her to say you can be afraid of an inanimate object? I mean, there are plenty of objects that offend my eyes, but I don't go and demand that they be torn down. I mean, I can think of statues, paintings, all kinds of emblems and things like that that I wouldn't demand the removal of, especially when it's part of American history. You may find it an uncomfortable part of American history, but it's just American history, and yet they're going to use anything they can to try to have these things removed from the scene in America, aren't they?
Yes, and I think they're trying to remove a certain portion of American history that interferes with their liberal message.
And yet it doesn't, because if you look at that Statue of Lee, think about all the places where slavery, for example, has existed on planet Earth, and in some cases, in parts of Africa, still exists today. And then think about the only country on planet Earth that shed blood over a conflict. One of the issues was slavery, and we resolved the issue, and previously we had crafted a document that said that all people are entitled to equal rights no matter how they're born or to whom they're born. And we are unique in the world because of that. And that's a part of American history. You could teach that young lady that Lee was on the wrong side of history in that case, but he is still part of American history, and what he did should be recognized. Thank you very much for the call, Jackie. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Real Red Meat Radio on the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails shortly, but one of the things that all of us worry about is how to protect your personal information from being hacked. In fact, I talk about LifeLock all the time as one of the things that you can use to protect yourself. Well, Troy Hunt joins me now, who's the Microsoft Regional Director and Independent Internet Security Researcher. Troy, it's good to have you on the program. Thanks for taking the time.
Hey, thanks very much for having me.
You know, I just got a scare myself this morning because there's a company that supplies these little kiosks in my workplace and a lot of other workplaces, you know, where you can buy soda pop or chips or whatever. And we just got a notice that that company was hacked. They found some malware over the 4th of July weekend, and it turns out that they had a lot of records hacked. And so it leaves you wondering, is my bank account safe? So You've got some ways that people can act proactively to try to protect themselves from this. Am I right?
Yeah. So, look, I mean, there's a combination of things people can do. So I run a free service called haveibeenpwned.com where people can see where they've previously had their accounts exposed. So, you know, for example, was your account leaked in the Dropbox data breach or the MySpace data breach? So one really useful thing people can do is have a look at that service. It's free. They can see where they've been exposed, and hopefully that gets them thinking a little bit more about their exposure online.
And how do? And when you say somebody's been, I guess they use the letter P instead of O in owned. That hackers use that as a term of art to describe hacking somebody, taking their email. What does it mean when somebody gets that information? How does that compromise them?
Well, one of the big problems we've got is that people reuse their passwords across services. And I'm sure there are many people listening who are nodding, going, yeah, I do that. And, hey, look, I've done it myself in the past as well because it's enormously convenient. And the problem then is that when you get a site that gets hacked and your credentials get leaked, so say your email address and your password, and you've reused them in other places, there are people who'll take that data and they'll try and log into your other accounts because they want to get access to your Gmail or your Amazon or your PayPal because there can be a lot of value in that. So, for example, there can be money in those accounts. There can be things that they monetize directly. So this is one of the big risks we've got, password reuse and then accounts getting compromised.
So what's your best advice for people, especially since an awful lot of the sites that you go to that require you to log in or register will ask you for your email address? Now, I mean, I use a number of different email addresses, but my main one is the one that I say on the air. So I'm already out there in the public. People know what my main email address is, and I tend not to use that one for security purposes.
Well, there's a few things, and certainly what you've just mentioned there is very useful. They're not reusing the same email address. But one thing you can do with many providers, such as Gmail, is you can have one email address, and maybe it's, say, john@gmail.com. But you can then create alternative aliases on that. So you can use John, and then you put the plus symbol, and then you might say Netflix@gmail.com and John+eBay@gmail.com. So you can have different email addresses on that one account that people won't necessarily know. So that would be one way of doing what you've just described there without creating separate accounts. The other thing that we really need people to do is to create unique passwords. Now, the challenge then is how do you create strong, memorable passwords, and it's actually very difficult. So this is where we have password managers. So there are dedicated pieces of software, so services like LastPass and 1Password, that are designed specifically to manage your passwords. And one of the best pieces of advice I can give people is to go and get a service like that. They're cheap, they're easy to use, and they make an enormous difference. And also turn on multi-step verification. So for example, Facebook allows you to log in with your email address and password and then says, hey, enter the code that's been generated on your smartphone just to make sure we know that you're you. And that is an enormously resilient way of protecting against these sorts of risks.
You know, the other thing, let me ask you, I use a technique, and I'll use one that's not one that I use, but if I say I want to write down or I want to record somewhere what my password is, but it's a dumb thing to write it down. So I think of a password. And let's say in high school, if I drove a red 55 Chevy in high school, and so I use red 55 Chevy with R capitalized and maybe Chevy capitalized as well. And then I write down in my note where I can look up my passwords, I write high school. And I know that high school refers to the car I drove in high school, but nobody else reading the words high school, they might think that meant Tillamook High School, 1977. But it doesn't mean that. It means something entirely different to me. So it's the mnemonic I used. Is that kind of technique one that's relatively bulletproof?
Well, that's certainly a lot better than reusing the same password everywhere.
Well, no, I use different passwords for almost everything, but then I need a way to remember what my passwords were. And the only way I can think of is to have a mnemonic and then figure if I lose my list of mnemonics, well, then I guess I'm in trouble and I'll have to go through the password recovery on every account I use.
So, you know, this is all about degrees. And if we think about this as a spectrum, using a weak password and using the same one everywhere is about as bad as it gets. Having a password manager and generating, say, 20 random characters for every single account you create is at the other end of the spectrum. And something like the mnemonics or passphrases or other patterns which create longer, not totally random, but less predictable passwords are somewhere in between. So I think, frankly, most people are at that really weak end of the spectrum. And we know this from looking at data breaches and looking at the passwords people use, that they're normally absolutely terrible passwords. So if you can start moving along that spectrum in the right direction, that's fantastic. If you can get all the way along there to the password manager style approach, then that's the best possible place you can be.
I'm talking to Troy Hunt. We'll give you his site again where you can check to see if you've been owned. But Troy, tell me this. What do you think of those password generators? And the thing I worry about is if I tell the password generator to generate these random strings of letters and numbers and symbols as my passwords, and then I have one password to get into that, do I run the risk that somewhere that will be hacked, and then my randomly generated passwords will end up in somebody's hands?
Well, look, all these approaches have different risks and then different likelihoods of that risk actually occurring and then a different impact if it does. So the risk we have when we try and use our brains to remember passwords is that they're generally weak and we often reuse them. So we have one account exposed and then other things get broken into. So we know that one. The risk of a password manager is that if someone gets in there, you have everything out there. And this is really sort of a putting your eggs in one basket sort of scenario. Offsetting that, the likelihood of that happening with a good password manager, the likes of LastPass or 1Password, and when you use them properly, so you need a password to get into that, which is why they're called LastPass or 1Password, so you have this sort of one master password. And if you have a very good, strong one master password, so one that you do remember, and you use the systems in the way it's designed, the likelihood of it happening is extremely remote. So you're sort of trading off against the high likelihood and the lower impact with using your brain, as opposed to a very, very, very small likelihood, but a high impact when you use a password manager.
Yeah, and you don't have any other reason to distrust those password managers as being yet another way for somebody to hack in and get your entire list of passwords.
Well, look, I certainly trust those organizations, and there's a few others doing good things as well. And inevitably, their whole business model is built around securing people's credentials. And whenever there's the slightest whiff of anything which isn't top-notch security-wise, they tend to jump on these things very quickly. So I certainly use those extensively. I'm confident in their security. And really, that is the best model that we've got at the moment in order to protect these things that we all have.
Hey, Troy, before we run out of time, tell people how to find your free site as well so people can find out if they've been owned.
Right. So you can go to haveibeenpwned, that's pwned.com. Plug your email address in. It will tell you if you're in a data breach. And if you like, you can tell the system to remember you so it can let you know if you appear in one later on.
Troy, thank you very much for the time.
My pleasure.
Back in just a moment. Glad to have you with me. 866-439-5277. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Connect with Lars 24/7 on Facebook and Twitter. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. As I told you earlier, the decision was made today by Mitch McConnell to actually hold the Senate in Washington, D.C. for an extra 2 weeks. Gee, giant sacrifice on their part to make sure that maybe they could get some more work done. I'm not sure that they're actually going to get anything done on health care, but at least they've allowed some additional time to do that. So I've invited Scott Atlas, senior fellow at the Hoover Institute and the author of Restoring Quality Health Care, to the program. Scott, good to have you back on.
Delighted to be here.
You see a real disconnect between people's principles in politics and healthcare reform and getting this done. Describe what you mean by that.
Well, the disconnect I see is that our legislators, congressmen, continue to focus on increasing the percentage of people with health insurance. But the reality is that health insurance premiums are really a secondary factor. The primary factor that determines health insurance affordability is the cost of medical care, and then to a lesser extent, the regulatory environment. And by ignoring the root problem and just supplementing people's money, but with money to pay for elevated insurance premiums, you're not getting rid of the issue, which is the cost of the care itself.
And we could. Do you think we could bend that cost curve if, for instance, I had an email from a gentleman today, and I didn't agree with the idea because I don't like the government mandates, but he said they ought to include in any health care reform that all health care institutions must disclose publicly the cost of each and every service. And I think, in theory, that sounds good. When I go to the grocery store, I can check prices. When I go to the hardware store, I can check prices. I'm not sure it applies to health care as well. Because of the nature of healthcare, but am I wrong about that, or do you think we could add that as well as sales across state lines of health insurance and other reforms like that?
Well, I think it is necessary to have knowledge of price if you're going to expect people to make a decision based on value, and part of the value proposition is the price. The thing is that there's something even more fundamental. So yes, I agree to some extent that people should know what they're being charged, but they need to care about the price. And when you have a third-party payer system or an insurance system like we have, which basically minimizes as much as possible the out-of-pocket prices, out-of-pocket payments, and distances the consumer from actually paying directly, then people don't have an incentive to really care about the price because they think someone else is paying. So you need to make some fundamental changes, get rid of a lot of the regulations that have created this sort of a perverse insurance system to begin with, and remove the obstacles to competition so that prices of the care come down and people actually care about the price and understand that they're actually paying for this medical care.
Well, and in fact, could you build some of that into conventional insurance? And here I'm not talking about the government mandating it, but if you said you have an insurance policy, if you decide you want to go in and get the most expensive drugs and the most expensive procedures, then perhaps your copay is higher. If you want to get the more basic or generic ones, we'll give you a lower copay. A private company could offer that insurance and let the customer decide. I want to get the brand name drug and I'm willing to pay 20% instead of 10%, or you know, things along that line. Does that one make sense? Because anytime you have a third party paying it, you're not going to care as much about the cost unless it affects how much you have to dig in your pocket for.
Well, it's essential that we need to have people using healthcare, people buying medical care about what it costs. And that means to introduce more vehicles for them so that they actually see what's being spent by themselves, meaning higher deductibles or whatever. And this is essentially what's behind Senator Cruz's amendment. Okay, he is proposing something that is very, very important, I believe, which is that we want to have a situation where if people want to pay for expensive insurance that covers everything, all kinds of coverage that they may or may not use, that's fine. But they should also be able to be offered insurance that is less comprehensive. In fact, yeah. I have insurance that is high deductible myself, but higher deductibles or less comprehensive mandated benefits get rid of some of these government mandates that have exploded in the states, but furthered by the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. So he's saying, fine, let's have these state exchanges or insurance coverage as they are, but also every state should be able to also offer consumers what consumers want, which is cheaper health insurance that isn't necessarily so comprehensive.
Well, and in fact, that's one of the big, I think, divides between the right and the left, because I hear the left saying, well, we can't let people choose the kind of insurance they want, because if we let them choose, they're going to choose the less expensive one that requires them to take on more responsibility. And for a conservative, the idea of being able to pay less and take on and own more of the responsibility for your own health care is a perfectly sensible idea. But for the left, they hate it.
Well, I mean, I just have a few comments on that.
Sure.
Specifically. Number one, when corporations have formed their own private group insurance exchanges and offered their employees different choices of insurance, more and more people have chosen, people prefer higher deductibles and less comprehensive coverage.
Right.
It's people. People spend their own money. When they're spending their money, they ought to have a choice on how to spend it. So that's number one. Secondly, you know, there's a great quote by Margaret Thatcher who said, socialists don't want people to have choice because they might not choose socialism. And that's exactly what's going on here. Thirdly, this was the same kind of argument made for people having control over their retirement money, you know, for 401k investments and things. You know, decades ago, no one had choices as to what to do with that money, because in a lot of the liberals, the left side of the equation here, felt that, oh, we can't have people have that kind of say in what to do with their investments because they're not capable. And, you know, frankly, that's just absurd.
All right. So what's the chance we're going to get any of this done by a Senate that doesn't seem willing to pass much of anything? And the Democrats who said, we're not going to take part in any of it.
Well, I mean, I'm not a political prognosticator, but I would say that there is no rational reason why you would believe that a Democrat is going to support an initiative under Donald Trump in his administration. So I wouldn't count on any votes, maybe one, but essentially zero Democrat support. So the votes have to be done by the Republicans, period. And your question, what do I think the chances are? I think actually the chances are a lot higher than the media are pushing the news about. I think that the Republicans, who control all the branches of government right now, understand it is their absolute promise and responsibility to put through a significant health care reform. And I actually think there's a very good chance that they will. It's not going to be perfect, but I think this is one of these examples of times where you can't let perfect be the enemy of good. And the proposals that I have seen, both from the House and the Senate, while I think there are significant, I have significant issues with both of them, they are both significantly better than the Affordable Care Act, which, as we know, is absolutely unsustainable. I mean, that's just factual.
Hey, Scott, let me ask you real quick. We got about 30 seconds left. Why didn't either of those proposals include sales across state lines and real competition?
Well, they did some things about getting rid of regulations that do inhibit some competition, but it's, you know, I think that there's a lot of politics obviously involved. These guys are politicians, and they respond to the incentives of politicians, not policymakers, unfortunately. But they didn't include a lot of things that I wanted. In fact, I don't think there should be refundable tax credits. I think that they should have addressed the tax issues very differently. There's all kinds of things in there that I disagree with, but I think the two common themes that they do both address are market enlargement of health savings accounts, which are very important, and allowing states to get out of these mandated insurance-type programs for the exchanges.
Very good point. Scott Atlas from the Hoover Institution. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your calls shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. And you've probably been hearing the news today that Donald Trump Jr. has now released a series of emails that indicate that he was offered the opportunity to hear some damaging information about Hillary Clinton and that he had the meeting, and that apparently nothing came of it. And I've asked John Fund to join me, who's a columnist for National Review and the author of Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk. John, it's great to have you on the program. Your name was the first one I thought of when I thought, who can tell us what the implications of this are?
Lars, I think we can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that Donald Trump Jr. is as dumb as a bag of rocks.
Okay. Now, you got to explain that one.
Well, even if nothing came of the meeting, and it looks as if nothing did, to have emails in which you are informed that this is a Russian government lawyer coming to visit you, and they're doing this at the behest of the Russian crown prosecutor because they favor Donald Trump's election, and you take the meeting and you invite your campaign chairman and the candidate's son-in-law to sit in on the meeting, compromising all of them, is that a swift move?
No. No, I would agree. I've never run a political campaign. I've never run for office and never hoped to. And I know that it would not make sense to take that kind of meeting. But he did take it. Did he break the law?
Probably not. Did he break what are established customs in American politics, at least until recently? You betcha. You know, we now know Ukraine was actively trying to elect Hillary Clinton president. They helped release damaging information on Paul Manafort, the campaign chairman for the Trump forces. And they worked with people who were consultants to the Democratic National Committee. So both sides were doing it. But Hillary Clinton's not president. Donald Trump is president. And the news media is going to give him no quarter on this. We're going to see the long, hot summer of congressional hearings. And we're going to see more references to Watergate than a leaky faucet.
You know, John, I don't want to jump to the everybody else does it, too. But let me ask you this. A couple of years ago, the Obama administration spent hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayer money to send people to Israel in an open attempt to try to influence the outcome of their election of Bibi Netanyahu. And we know that's true because a Senate committee held a hearing on it,
right,
and they took testimony on it. So and that wasn't just our government trying to influence election and spend our money. It was, you know, and we were doing it relatively openly. So how often do you suppose it's the case that some other governments, whether it's France or Germany or England or anyone else, tries?
It happens all the time, and we do it all the time. But you cannot get around the following fact, Lars. Russia is an adversary of ours.
Yep.
Vladimir Putin is a thug, and he runs a completely corrupt government that is against U.S. interests. And Donald Trump has had so many bizarre formulations of why he thinks Russia might not have hacked us, might not have done something, playing footsie with Putin, that it gives rise to suspicion. And the real problem here is this. As you've always heard, the cover-up is worse than the initial offense.
Yep. All the way
Donald
from back
Trump
to Watergate.
Donald Trump Jr. denied any such meeting happened. Paul Manafort denied any such meeting happened. Donald Trump then said, well, if there was a meeting, it was about adoptions. And then he said, well, if it was a meeting, you know, I didn't know about anything about, you know, the Russian government. Now we know that he was told the Russian government was involved, and his response was, I love it. I'd love it even more if it happens later in the summer, i.e. closer to the election. So at a minimum, there's a cover-up here, even if there's no specific crime. If you want health care reform, you want to get rid of Obamacare, you want a wall at the border, you want tax reform this fall, this makes it immeasurably more difficult for it to happen. And frankly, it is the Trump administration's self-destructiveness at work.
Yeah. And so is this just because the folks like Donald Trump Jr. and Donald Trump Sr. don't have any experience in politics, which I always thought of as a plus rather than a minus? I don't trust people more because they've been in office a long time or because they've run for many offices. I almost trust them less because of my experience
but
with government.
Even if having no experience in politics is a plus, you still have to have intelligence.
Yeah.
And look, Donald Trump, at a minimum, should have protected himself by going to everyone involved and saying, now's the time to talk. Now's the time to tell me, you know, did anything happen? Was there any meeting? You know, this could even have been a sting operation. After all, this woman had nothing, apparently, you know, was just there as a pretext. Maybe this was the Russians' time to compromise both campaigns, compromise Hillary by stealing her email server, material and compromising Trump by setting up a meeting which could he could later be blackmailed with. Oh. Leaving that aside, this was not only incredibly stupid and immoral, it beggars description as to what in the world they were doing covering it up, because obviously Jared Kushner, to give you security clearance, and Paul Manafort, because he was registering as a lobbyist, ultimately revealed this meeting. They should have revealed it months ago. The fact that they're revealing it now is a disservice to President Trump. They have, I think, put him in an impossible position by engaging in a cover-up. I suspect Trump never knew about the meeting, but his son and his former campaign manager have really, I think, put him in an impossible position.
Yeah, it does sound like it's a tough spot. And when you mentioned the pretext, it's because she really did want to talk to the Trumps about this issue of adoptions and the specific American law.
Only in the context of getting rid of sanctions against specific named Russian officials who were barred from entering the U.S. or barred from financial transactions with U.S. companies. So it was about adoptions only to the extent that that's how Putin retaliated against us for passing these sanctions against individual Russians who had violated the civil rights of this political prisoner who died in their custody.
I just find this really ironic that the media is now getting very excited about this when, as you say, it's something that's a regular part of politics, except that more experienced politicians say, well, send somebody out who's not directly connected to the campaign, have them listen to the information, then bring it back to us. In other words, you use what intelligent people might call a cutout so that you can say,
what does Roger Stone exist for other than this? This is why Roger Stone was invented. I think you're going to, if this is it, there's no crime here. There's, I think, a very, very collusive atmosphere and something which is a stain on the president's victory. Even if nothing came of it, and apparently so far it hasn't. I think the president has to make a clean breast of this. He has to get the information out now in the summer. Otherwise, he's going to kiss Obamacare. He's going to kiss tax reform. He's going to kiss the wall goodbye.
What do you think, if you were advising him right now, what would be the best move for the president at this point, given what's already out on the table?
Well, the first advice I'd give him is something he can't follow, which is one of the reasons you shouldn't have family members in politics, which is he should fire his son.
Okay, and his son-in-law as well?
Probably.
Because
his son-in-law failed to disclose the meeting in original documents he used to get a security clearance.
John, I appreciate you taking the time to explain all this, and I appreciate your insights.
Thank you, Lars.
You bet. John Fund, columnist for National Review and the author of Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk. We'll be back in just a moment. I'll get to your calls at 866-439-5277. Emails to talk@LarsLarson.com.